The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Hello and welcome to the Seth Liebson Show. It is not Seth Liebson. It is definitely not butter. I am Lewis Holloman, Managing Director of Insight Analytics. Grateful as always to Seth Liebson for the opportunity to guest host. I am joined today in studio by the Frankenstein to my Adam, Hugh Holloman, noted attorney, activist and man about town. How are you today, sir?
I think you and your brothers call me a professional meddler, but it's a delight and honor to be here.
I'm afraid I can't say on air what my brothers and I call you.
All right. Wow. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, a proud father. Here he is. I am delighted to be with you, Lewis, and I thought we would kick off this first hour today talking about what is being bounced around as the axis of evil. Russia, China, and Iran, and how they are working together, and my being confounded by the fact that we have conservatives pulling up stakes on our efforts to support Ukraine against Russia, and the Democrats and liberals pulling up stakes in their support for Israel, which is our best source of combating directly Iran, and all of those efforts help to keep China from believing that the U.S. is a weak ally and that China can therefore eventually roll into the straits and take over Taiwan. Your thoughts?
So lots to unpack there, certainly. I'm reminded of the notion that there is nothing so hateful as a heretic, right? Someone who shares almost all of our values, but who is just so close, but so far on that one issue or whatever it may be. And that's something I find that, you know, maybe is characterizing the political discourse of late, in that as Americans, there is a perhaps a remarkable degree on that we do share, that we do have in common. But it's sort of the fringe cases of culture and the culture war, where sort of the rubber is meeting the road and we are increasingly at each other's throats there. So you outlined sort of three major actors, Iran, Russia, and China. And, you know, on the surface of it, those nations don't necessarily have a ton in common, right? You know, other than they're in sort of greater Eurasia and largely authoritarianism. But I think I'd like to, if that's all right, why don't we spend the show today kind of unpacking this axis of evil, or maybe as if I may update the Cold War terminology you're using, I would say anti-Western authoritarian regimes.
Deal. I'll take that.
All right. Fair enough. And so why don't we start with, I think I'm gonna pillage heavily from someone whose writing I admire tremendously. If you've not read Stephen Kotkin's biography of Stalin, you very much should. It's masterful. But
two volumes out, the third one still in
work. Coming out, yeah. That's two volumes are about 2,000 pages, so there's plenty to read through while you wait.
Yeah, and in fact, I would caution you that reading it all at once is so daunting, not because of its length, because of its sheer the horror of what Stalin is executing in the time he comes to power under Lenin and then takes full control by murdering off his colleagues and competitors.
Right.
And then what he does to Russians, Ukrainians, Kazakhs, and everyone else who fill the space that the Soviet Union had taken over. But with that.
Right. So Kotkin outlines a sort of a notion about modern authoritarian states and modern authoritarian regimes. And he notes a change that happened after the collapse of the Soviet Union that has been sort of animating a lot of the activity since then. And his notion, it's a little pithy, but it goes like this. It's that communism is dead, but fascism has a future. And the reason he described it that way is that the Soviet Union's collapse, it was almost magical from a Western perspective, right? We had spent, you know, the better part of five decades thinking that the world could end in a ball of fire in Armageddon, and that ultimately what would have to happen would be a grand military clash across the plains of Europe, likely through Germany and Poland, where the fate of the world would be decided. And ultimately, the Iron Curtain fell, and it wasn't bombs that won the war, but culture and institutions and Coca-Cola and blue jeans. And so, remarkably, communism fell. And it fell because of not through, again, military means, but those cultural means. The ability fundamentally of elites within the communist system, within Volgograd itself in East Germany, when they would look out, they used Western luxury goods as their own internal markers of status. And that is the sign that the system failed utterly, because even though they were communists at heart, their own system couldn't compete. And so the reason that communism is dead is because it does not provide a system wherein the elites can extract plunder and use it to actually upgrade their dachas in a meaningful way. Compare and contrast that now to the modern sort of Russian oligarch system that happened with privatization and sort of the fallout that occurred as, you know, former factory owners or military colonels or KGB officers were able to coerce their workers and employees into giving them sort of the stock certificates when all of the communist factories were carved up, which then created the modern fortunes that we see. There were also, you know, rigged auctions at midnight in the woods while they were divvying up natural state resources, all sorts of activity. All of this is to say, ultimately, that these new regimes are not communistic in nature. They are fascistic. They are plundering regimes, and they are
a sense of what you mean by fascist versus communist in terms of ownership and that structure, that why the plunder works only under one and not the other.
Yeah, sure. So the issue with communism as a mechanism with the notion of communal ownership of goods, there is no state. There is no space for you to then extract anything from the system and say, this is my stuff, right? Everything sort of gets back into the pile, and all of the restrictions on what you can own mean that it's hard to actually extract anything. What fascism, by being the fusion of state and corporate power, effectively gives you is it doesn't have this redistributive component of it. And so you are then able to abscond with and keep whatever you can carve out of the system for yourself. And so that then...
As well-earned gains.
Right, exactly. And then that can give you your 300 million yacht parked in Monaco, you know, for instance, or allow you to buy English soccer teams or whatever you're doing as a modern oligarch and plunderer. But these states, these modern authoritarian states, they have four things that they need to function. And those four things are, number one, you need a revenue stream. You don't need growth, right? Economic growth is not necessarily part of the picture. There's no social contract that needs to be had in China where you're enslaving Uyghurs. What you need is a revenue stream that can be that you can control, that is centralized. And things like oil or diamond mining or things like that are often better because you actually don't need an educated workforce other than foreign contractors to pull that stuff out of the ground. You can keep your own population impoverished and still succeed that way.
North Korea, for example.
Exactly. The next thing that you need. So the first thing, again, is you need
the income stream.
The next thing that you need is a coercive mechanism. Some sort of army, some sort of force, some sort of way to get people to do what you want. Then the third thing that you need is control over life chances, the ability to reward and punish people with discretion, right? If you play ball with the regime, maybe you get to be in the army, you get to be an officer. If you don't play ball, your stuff can be expropriated, you can be put into camps, what have you. The final thing that you need are stories. You need a deep well of stories and resentment and enemies. And you need something to then bind and unify. If you can get those four things together, you can create a hardy and resilient authoritarian state. And it's that last piece, the stories, that I think are animating a lot of the discussion. So much of what is going on in the world is an attempt to create a degree of moral equivalence between the United States and its Western allies and these anti-Western authoritarian states. And when we come back and throughout the day, I want to keep picking up on that topic as we proceed.
I'm Hugh Hallman. He's Lewis Hallman. Thank you again to Seth Liebson for allowing us to host the Seth Liebson Show in his absence. We are here on 960 KKNT, The Patriot. We'll be back in just a moment.
Welcome back to the Seth Liebson Show here on 60 KKNT, The Patriot. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a call at 602-508-0960. I'm here in studio with my father, Hugh Hallman, as we have been...
And you would be?
I am Lewis Hallman, thank you, Managing Director of Insight Analytics, as we have been discussing anti-Western illiberalism, or in your words, the axis of evil.
The old man's language of the axis of evil.
And, you know, having a look around the world and thinking about what our place is it and how we should proceed and go forward from where we are currently.
And I sort of start with the issue, because we talk about this a lot, that we've got Russia invading Ukraine, clearly the aggressor, clearly committing an immoral act and an immoral war in violation of the Budapest Memorandum that said that the Ukrainian territory would be sacrosanct, that they would be completely, where the borders completely respected. Russia signed it, the U.S. signed it, Great Britain signed it, and Northern Ireland signed that memorandum in 1994 in exchange for Ukraine giving up its nuclear weapons, an important agreement. And then the administration went forward, by then it was the Clinton administration, went forward to seek to have the parties that had agreed to those kinds of maneuvers. There were two countries, Kazakhstan and Ukraine, had given up their nuclear weapons. Kazakhstan entered a Lisbon Agreement, and Ukraine entered the Budapest Memorandum, gave up their nuclear weapons in exchange for protection that nobody would get to run into their territory. Then we have long-time treaty organizational structure for Israel and its protection, and lots of work, including up through the Trump administration, on the Abraham Accords to create a better, more peaceful environment and begin to bring the Arab countries into commerce with Israel. It had not happened before until we got the accords with Egypt.
And that was by means of formal recognition, right?
That is correct. And so now we had Saudi getting closer to Israel, and then the complete destruction of both of these regime structures in the last couple of years. Now, we've talked about those. We have this third player, Iran, who is helping Hamas to destroy Israel. We have Russia working to destroy at least half of Ukraine and take it over with the help of Iran and China. It's those three parties, Russia, China, and Iran, that are working together to create destabilization in the West for their own interests. But I talk a lot about the Middle Eastern issue and the Russia-Ukraine issue. Lewis spends a lot of time studying China, and we have the new round of professional security folks in the U.S., our team of defense and spy folks, now going before Congress repeatedly and saying they need more money and raising the flag of the risk of China going into Taiwan. And Lewis, I think you've studied that more than anybody I know. Why don't you provide your insights?
Absolutely. So you actually, you sent me a headline recently that was a U.S. admiral warning about the unprecedented buildup of China's navy, that it's been built up on a scale unseen since the Second World War.
Unseen since the Second World War.
This is one of those wonderful things that the press will do. Well, they will find whatever innumerate way they can do to say something.
Innumerate way. Hear that again. Innumerate way, meaning they don't understand numbers.
So they'll take whatever statistic they're trying to display, and they will reshape it into the most it leads, it bleeds, scary version of the headline possible. And so ultimately, if you think about what that statement means, that a naval buildup beyond what anyone else has done since the Second World War.
Beyond what China has done since the Second World War.
Well, here's the thing. There was no navy since the Second World War other than the U.S. Navy in any real sense. Yes, the Soviets had a Blue Water Navy, but it was split over four different seas and never able to concentrate and very, very small. It really is a sort of a stumpy service, really. The Soviets were much more about their nukes, their artillery, and their ground forces, not at all their navy. And so to say that it is true that China is building on a scale not seen since the Second World War, but all that means is that anyone in the world is building naval vessels at all in a way that they expect some sort of great power competition to occur. That's all that means, because if the last 80 years have been historically atypical because we have been living under this Pax Americana, wherein every other industrialized economy was destroyed after the Second World War. And so that gave us deranged expectations, not only of what should American economic growth look like, because we're coming into a world basically for a full century with a tremendous first mover advantage. And now that has eroded, we're surprised that other countries are, you know, growing more quickly than us. It's because they're not burned down anymore. It turns out you can get a lot of economic growth very quickly by building something for the first time.
For the first time, and that's a big piece to note, is that when China is now expanding its navy beyond belief since World War II, if you start with one ship and build a second one, you've just doubled your navy.
Right.
That's the kind of innumerate problem that we have with the press.
The other thing as well is that the press will report the number of vessels produced. And on paper, yes, China does have more warships in number than the U.S. does. But a 2,000-ton coastal patrol vessel is not the same thing as a 100,000-ton nuclear-powered aircraft carrier. That one of these things is not like the other. One of these things just doesn't belong, if I may steal some Sesame Street.
Yes, well, you were raised in that era, I must admit.
And so, you know, ultimately, the Chinese are operating a navy that is an area denial force that can not sail more than about 500 miles from their coast under combat conditions. So, yes, such a navy could threaten Taiwan, but it is not something that causes me to lose a lot of sleep. On the subject of Chinese building, though, this is a statistic I learned recently that I was floored by. Do you know how much spare housing is in China? How many housing units there are? The number of people that you could house? How many do you think? Just throw a number out.
Well, I happen to know they went on a huge building binge over
they
the last 20 years.
Yep.
And financed it through massive debt structures.
They used more concrete than the rest of the world combined, yeah.
And they were getting it from all over the world.
So how many people do you think, how many spare bedrooms do you think there are in China?
Well, given that they've hit a wall on their growth, I got to believe the spare bedrooms that they have, a billion four in numbers of people? Or is that?
That's the state statistic. Yeah. The real number is probably 1.2 billion. If you look at the Shanghai Academy of Arts, they've been overcounting their population by about 150 million for fraud. We'll talk about that in the next section.
And so if they are talking spare bedrooms, I got to believe, given the building spree they went on in their major cities, apartment buildings galore that I saw myself,
yep,
empty in 2012.
Uh-huh.
So I got to believe they've got, 300 million extra bedrooms.
Okay, so cool. That's a great number. So 300 million
extra
is the
bedrooms.
Number of extra bedrooms in the entire rest of the world that is not China. That is all of the spare housing stock that exists. 300 million people is about what we could house in all of the rest of the world, not China. The Chinese number that you could house just with spare Chinese housing stock is between 1 and 1.5 billion people.
So they have twice as much housing stock as they need and nobody to
fill
it and
pay the rent. It is 70% of their savings. Their housing bubble has not started yet, and it is just about starting to. The Chinese economy is not one that scares me very much. Let's keep going on this when we come back, though. I am Lewis Hallman. He has been Hugh Hallman. This is 960 The Patriot, and we are love to continue this conversation with you.
We'll be right back. Please join us in the call. Call us if you'd like to join the conversation. Thanks so much.
Hello, and welcome back to the Seth Liebson Show. I am Lewis Hallman, and joined by Hugh Hallman here at 960 The Patriot. We've been talking about authoritarian anti-Western regimes right now, and we've got a call from Charles in Phoenix wanting to join the conversation. Charles, you are on the air.
Hi, I read that NATO broke its promise to Putin and expanded by, I think it was 14 nations after they told him they wouldn't do it. Is that correct?
So NATO has expanded, but there was never a formal promise to Putin in any sort of treaty binding way that said that that we would not, or that NATO would not expand.
You do have a narrative, Charles, that some people are putting out, that Vladimir Putin asked to join NATO and was turned down. First, he was positively responded to by our president at the time and then turned down. The challenge that Vlad and all of the countries, the reason Ukraine was not admitted yet, is because the structures that the Soviet Union had put in place were so counter-democratic and counter-transparency that nobody could trust and did not want to trust, bringing them into the club where they would then have access to very highly secret and very important defense strategies for the West. But go ahead, Charles.
Well, I saw an interview. A guy was interviewing Bush. Bush 2, I think it was.
Yep.
And he asked him about that. And his answer was, well, times change. And stories I've seen lead me to believe that Putin's totally justified in what he did in Ukraine. Furthermore, I think Putin is a far better man than any of the leaders we have. The closest one we have to him is Trump, because he actually promotes Christianity, and he's against the alphabet mob, and in fact has declared him to be a terrorist, to be terrorists.
So, Charles, having spent significant time in Russia, Ukraine, and Kazakhstan, and countries of the former Soviet Union, I can tell you that I would agree with you that Vladimir Putin has as his mission to reconstitute a branch of Christianity to run an entire society. He is trying to recreate the Eastern Orthodox regime that existed prior to the Soviet Union. And that is not one that most Christians in the West would recognize as transparent, open, or supportive of liberty. It tends to be an authoritarian regime itself. I don't happen to think that that's the direction that our society would want to go, and it's certainly not supported by the philosophy that was imbued into the Constitution of these United States. I do get that there are people promoting the idea that somehow Vladimir Putin is a wonderful leader, but when you think about the destruction of the Russian economy and what the people of that society are now put through, it's to me very much like saying that in the 1930s that Adolf Hitler was a wonderful person and was really developing Germany. They have used the same kinds of tactics. And now you have, as an example, Vladimir Putin trying to blame an ISIS attack on its people on Ukraine and coming up with narratives to suggest that somehow Ukraine supported it. In this instance, the U.S. Services knew more than a month ago that ISIS was planning attacks and actually alerted Russia about that, notwithstanding that we're in the middle of a very fierce battle. And Russia took that information, did not continue to monitor the situation, and ISIS fighters got into and positioned themselves to murder Russians. He now wants to use that narrative to blame Ukraine. Let's keep in mind, what you are arguing is that because Vladimir Putin saw NATO to the West getting larger, that then implies that somehow he is justified in attacking Ukraine on the grounds that what? NATO was nation building? NATO was an occupying force of Russian territory? Do I understand Russian paranoia? Yeah, we can talk about that when we come back. And the basis on which the Russians are paranoid, they have frequent reason to be paranoid, but they also have a culture of destruction that led to tens of millions of people dying needlessly. And I don't support that. We'll be just back in a couple of minutes. I'm Hugh Hallman. He's Lewis Hallman. And we're grateful, Charles, that you would take the time to join the conversation. We may not agree on everything, but we can at least have a respectful discussion. We'll be right back.
Hello, and Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. I am Lewis Hallman. Seth was gracious enough to allow me to guest host for him, and I've been joined in studio by my father, Hugh Hallman, as we've been discussing anti-Western authoritarianism. And it's been a wild one, frankly. We were talking, I think we had the call with Charles in the last segment, and we were discussing what the justification is for Russia's invasion of Crimea. And I think that I want to step back for a moment and offer sort of, as I see them, the different lanes that you could reasonably get to a Russian justification
or
of
try
the invasion,
to get to, yeah.
Or try to. The first would be a historical claim of ownership of Crimea based on Russian imperial holdings. Now, this claim would then be rooted in the Russian Empire, which is two governments ago. So shaky.
To be clear, in 1783, Russia got Crimea by defeating the Ottoman Empire. The Tsarist Empire defeated the Ottoman forces and took Crimea.
Correct.
So it's 1783 is when Russia...
Was it Catherine or Peter the Great?
I can't remember which Tsar, but it doesn't matter. The point being is that then Russia ends up with it. Then in 1954, in February 1954, Khrushchev, through a variety of processes, makes the decision that Russia will cede Crimea to Ukraine. So a Georgian gave Crimea away from Russia to Ukraine. That's the setup for what happens in 2014.
Right. And so the ultimately then we have the invasion in 2014. I would also point to the 2012 Orange Revolution, where we see what Russia describes as a coup of the president that they then backed at the time. Lukashenko, I believe his name
was. But keep in mind, what we're talking about is Russia complaining that a sovereign nation's people undertake a revolutionary effort, sound familiar, and overthrow Russian puppets who were running their country and replace them with Ukrainians.
Right. So it would be...
Oh, I don't know, like the United States people joining together in 1776 and saying, I'm sorry, England, we no longer are going to let you install puppets to run our lives. We want to dictate our own future and create our own government that's going to be run by people who are born and raised here. We call them Americans.
Right. And then the final piece is the narrative piece that Charles outlined. Now, for this argument to work, right, for that to be the case, you have to subscribe to the notion that we are sort of in a spheres of influence world and that it is the prerogative of great powers to control the sovereignty and destiny of those within nations along their borders. And so you could make the case that there is justification, but in doing so, you then have to open up some very interesting cans of worms for Canada, Mexico, I don't know, Belgium, Vietnam, Kazakhstan, Korea, any small country at the periphery of a larger one with a larger military.
Well, okay, and Charles, let's not forget then Saudi Arabia has every right to go into Israel.
Right. Absolutely. Right?
It's Israel is in the Saudi zone of influence, and that they therefore on that kind of a justification have the right.
They might
to
have
go
to
in.
Fight the Turks for it.
Yeah, indeed. Turkey might decide to go back in, but the whole Ottoman Empire concept grew up in an era that was preceded by the folks from China and Genghis Khan creating the largest empire that ever existed. Those are the kinds of arguments we can get in, Lewis. I think let's talk in the third hour about this notion of when you set the time you're going to deal with, that it gives you more information about the person making the argument than it does about the argument they're making.
Sure, sure.
That is to say, depending on the timeline I choose. Now, I certainly sitting here can justify why Russia said, you know what, Crimea is ours and we're going to take it back, notwithstanding that we signed a treaty with U.S., Great Britain, and Northern Ireland, and Ukraine gave up its nuclear weapons, that Crimea was included in that territory for Ukraine. I can justify on the grounds that, as Lewis noted, this was a Tsarist Russian holding that only in 1954 got transferred from Russia, from the Russian Republic in the Soviet Union, to the Ukrainian Republic in the Soviet Union.
Although we should also understand that the Soviet republics themselves were deliberately constructed to make ethnic rebellion within the larger USSR fundamentally impossible. So they were deliberately built so that you had a confusing hodgepodge mishmash of military installations as well as ethnic peoples scattered throughout what effectively was the Russian Empire transitioned into the Soviet system.
My point being, Charles, that if you're still listening, that you've got a Ukraine in which the Russians take Crimea. And what did the U.S. do? We as conservatives blamed Barack Obama for failing to enforce the Budapest Memorandum. Then he started drawing red lines that if opponents cross those red lines, he would now certainly pull out the brickbat and beat them. And then he didn't. What did that do to our international reputation? As everybody's falling over themselves to love Barack Obama, award him a Nobel Prize in anticipation of his administration's great work, we lose Crimea. His handmaiden, Bill Clinton's bride, Hillary, as his Secretary of State, hits the reset button with Vlad, and then they both bend over and let him do whatever they'd like. That was the reality. And if you're now getting in bed with those people who said Barack Obama was right, then understand what you've just committed to. Because now you're committing to the idea that Russia's allowed to take territory of the surrounding independent nations and do so on the grounds that they've ceded the ground with Russians to try to create false flag opportunities, which they've been doing for 100 years, and then use that as the justification to say that Ukraine isn't a real country, that Ukraine never really existed. They're saying that about Poland. They're saying that about Kazakhstan and other countries that surround them, which gets you Lewis's point that if what we're going to do is say a large, powerful country gets to control the countries around it and that they don't exist in reality and they don't have independent life, then that's the story you just bought.
Right. And effectively, then what we've done is we've transformed Russia overnight from a country of 120 million people that is in rapid demographic decline. And we've given them sovereignty over another quarter of a billion people.
That's right. We're now saying, you know what, Vlad, you were right. The Soviet Union was a better enemy for us to have. We understood them. So let's recreate the Soviet Union and have these battles all over again that took us massive amounts of treasure. To cause the choice was Soviet Union, you either reform and allow your people and these independent societies to exist and prosper, or you will collapse. They ultimately made the decision that they were going to try to stand their ground, and we outspent them hugely in our defense expenditures, and it caused the collapse of the Soviet Union. That's the reality, Charles. And anybody who now believes and does not understand that by allowing Vladimir Putin to do what he's doing, you are supporting China. Allowing Vladimir Putin to do what he's doing, you are supporting Iran. Those three powers work together to advance their cause to create mayhem in the world. So if you want to protect Israel from Hamas and Iran, we must continue to pressure Vladimir Putin.
Thank you so much for spending this hour with us. I have been Lewis Hallman, joined by Hugh Hallman. We have one quick call as we can finish up this hour. Jack in Phoenix, if we can get your call real quick. You're on the air.
How you doing?
Doing very well, thanks.
Yeah, I live in Arizona, originally from Chicago. I've been here almost 17 years, and I love it here. But I'm worried about this country quite a bit. And then I was listening to Gorka. And they were talking about the FBI that should be disbanded because they're so crooked. So I thought of something, maybe put an FDI, Federal Department of Investigation, but they don't carry no guns, no nothing. If they find some stuff that's going on wrong, they should call a hierarchy, like people with guns and stuff like that. That's the only thing I think of because they're so crooked. Now, they ain't like old school FBI. They're just woke, or whatever you want to call it.
Give us a second, Jack, so we can respond, because we are going to close out the hour here. What I can say is this, that the challenge we face is it doesn't really matter whether you disband the FBI or create it under another category. What we have to deal with is the fact that our society needs to have a police agency at the federal level that protects us from bad people. Our biggest challenge is if the FBI is an indicator of what can happen to an agency, it is true across government agencies that we have created monsters that now exercise so much authority freely that they can now invade our private space and cause us all as individuals exercising our liberty to have less liberty and feel that the society is no longer working for us, creating a level of anger that I think is as disruptive.
This comes back to our whole notion of institutions and culture by design. If we want to have an open and a fruitful and a free society, then it behooves us to empower an institution carefully. And so it may be that the FBI's purview has expanded. Certainly, cyber surveillance and the like has been renewed since the Patriot Act was instantiated without a fuss every year. And it is well within, I think, our prerogative as free people to have a conversation about what surveillance we're able to endure, what institutions we want to have, and what kind of life we'd like to leave for ourselves. But ultimately, if the state is going to run roughshod over us, then we will be trapped perennially in infighting and the quagmire that we're in. We cannot get a breath of fresh air if we are feeling trapped and hunted.
In fact, we're going to talk with one of our state leaders, Speaker of the House of Representatives, Ben Thoma, who will be with us shortly. And we're going to talk about his origin story, a little reminiscent of what's happened with our president's origin story, that it may be completely made up and a falsehood beyond belief. But Mr. Thoma has a great origin story that is worth your listening to, and he is demonstrating a leadership quality and a character that I think is remarkable. We don't have enough such folks in our community, so we'd like to make sure you know about Ben Thoma. We'll be right back with Speaker of the House of Representatives, Ben Thoma.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.